Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and today I'm joined by Gabriel Krauser. Gabriel, how are you today?
Very well, Nick. How's it?
Do you feel youthful and after youth day?
Not especially. I do feel like I was confronted by a lot more reasons to be grumpy about the fact that most people my age and younger don't have a job. But I did also get the chance to walk in the park, which is a great relief to me.
Well, that's sort of good.
Rejuvenation.
And same question to you, because, of course, we are joined by Sara Gon. Sara, do you feel more youthful after Youth Day?
It would take a lot of Youth Day to make me feel more youthful, but the aloes at Emirates Dam were wonderful.
So those who are watching the show on YouTube may notice that my camera is a bit fuzzy. I'm not sure of the reason for that. I will be trying to fix it. But that I'm slightly less fuzzy, and I finally have caved to social pressure and trimmed my beard, which is giving me very mixed feelings. But anyway, let us start with our first exciting and explosive story of today. And that is, of course, comments by the person the media loves to hate, Miss Helen Ziller, who has attacked the EFF for hosting a Youth Day rally. This is a quote from her. I think it was on Twitter. "We all know that Malema does not want an October election. The IEC has said the only reason for postponing the election would be if rampant COVID-19 runs out of control. So Julius holds super spreader rallies as he did today. This is a transparent strategy to postpone elections." So that's quite an explosive claim. Gabriel, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think it's worth just always remembering that postponing an election by a couple of months, not in itself a big deal, but this is not the call. If the elections are postponed, the push will be to postpone them until 2024. This has been a long-standing item on the agenda of the ANC and its sort of ex officio youth league, the EFF. That is why this matters so much. I think that it is clearly the case. The EFF was in favor of the most brutal, hard form of lockdown that could be imaginable. And now that it suits it, it seems to be flying in the face of that. Just a few background notes about the state of coronavirus in the country. Based on the best available data a month ago, it seemed like so many South Africans had already been infected and recovered from COVID-19 that despite the lack of vaccinations, the third wave was likely to be less extreme than the first or second in terms of deaths and hospitalizations. Now, generally, the pattern is following that prediction in the sense that the ratio of cases, so there's still lots of cases, but the ratio of cases to severe illness and death is much lower this time than it was in the same period of the wave in the last two times. The exception that we flagged, particularly through a report that was done through the Center for Risk Analysis, was in Gauteng and in other parts of the country where the bourgeoisie, the wealthy people with the capacity to protect themselves from infection throughout the last year by having white-collar jobs where they can work from home, living in perhaps in old-age homes that are relatively well isolated, that they would still be at serious risk because there is no antecedent herd protection coming out of previous infection in those regions. Insofar as we are seeing serious illness and death, it does seem to be coming from exactly those sources. And so it's worth reiterating the kinds of cautions that people are probably sick of hearing, that if you're lucky enough to be in one of those communities where most people you know haven't yet been infected, then that means you're unlucky enough to be in the kind of position where your chances of infection, if you are going to parties and hanging out without much social distancing, are very high. In my own circle, a dozen people have been infected in the last week and in the last 2 weeks, and all really from two events. So that were sort of parties that people attended. So it is worth being very careful. And that's all I'll really say.
Right. So you did avoid answering my question, though, about what you thought of Helen's comments.
No, I started by saying I think it's right to note that the EFF has played the hypocrite here, that has called for harsh lockdown, and now it's calling for party rallies at a time where that seems to be imprudent and at a time that seems to serve an agenda of not just postponing the election by a couple of months, but in fact by a few years.
Yes, yes. So... Yeah, sorry, let me get your thoughts first.
Well, I have to give Helen credit for sort of coming out of the starting blocks and saying about the EFF what most of us would have said about the EFF if we had that sort of clout. And because, I mean, my impression is that of late there's been more and more statements that reveal hypocrisy, and I would go with it's not just the push to... push out the elections to 2024. I think that's definitely been on the agenda. But it's also the fact that it seems VBS is closing in a little bit more. You know, Floyd Chivamba's brother Brian has admitted essentially handing money over to them that they didn't earn from VBS, full stop. So I think they're trying to distract, but they're contradicting themselves by having both this event yesterday and sort of gatherings at schools they declared racist, or they want to march on the medicines approval authority because we haven't got enough vaccinations and we haven't got them soon enough. It in the circumstances, it is particularly childish, and I've no doubt Julius or Floyd will sort of respond in kind with knobs on, but it's a fun way of doing it, let's put it this way.
Right, the EFF does seem to have a very particular ability to sort of weave the rules to be different when we do it. This happens all the time. Yeah, I'm curious as to, so I think it's a bit hardcore of Helen to say this. I get where she's coming from, and it's an interesting theory, but I don't really know even if that would work necessarily to have massive rallies that could. Maybe it does. Anyway,
no, I don't think it. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I'm not sure that it does work in terms of creating super spreaders, having outdoor events. With the science, the best science that's available seems to indicate that.
Right.
Outdoor open air things, not the biggest thing. So I think, and also I don't believe it's the case that if you spread coronavirus lots now in June, that it's going to increase the number of cases that are around in September. And as far as I can tell, the elections are scheduled really for right at the end of
October.
The year. Exactly.
Yeah, for basically the end of October.
So I think this speaks more to the intent than the effect.
Yes,
and
yes,
that's
yes,
where one can disambiguate, because other people might want to have rallies where they really are not intending to spread coronavirus at all, and it's crazy to think they are. Now, maybe it's a little bit of a stretch to suppose that they're trying to spread coronavirus here, but there's just a pattern and practice that supports the position somewhat. Yeah.
So I would say I would definitely not put it beyond the moral sensibilities of the EFF to pull something like that. I do think that they have a very disposable attitude towards some of their supporters, in that they don't necessarily care that much about their well-being so long as the revolution is advanced.
If I can just say that I think one of the problems for the EFF and for the wanting the extension is that if they could have local elections with provincial and national, they would hope to do better, because they do not run a single municipality or district. I mean,
So this is a question.
Yeah,
this is a question I actually wanted to ask you guys. Is that, is this good? Is postponing the election good politics for the EFF? Because one could make the argument that it is, but one could also make the argument that it's going to hurt them, because ANC voters tend to come out less on municipal elections, and that as a proportion of the vote, the EFF will actually possibly do better. I'm not sure which way it would swing, but that is one theory. So if one views this as a political party strategy, it's a little bit ambiguous. But if one views the EFF now solely as an internal ANC pressure group, then it seems to make a lot more sense to me. So, Gabriel, what are your thoughts on that? Do you think the EFF is doing this for their own electoral reasons, or do you think this is part of some bigger power play within the internal politics of the ANC? I think the EFF has become far more interested in the internal politics of the ANC over the last since Zuma was gone, basically.
Right. So that's exactly it. The EFF's return back into the fold in any kind of official capacity was impossible while Zuma was still in charge, because they had made such a song and dance about not liking him. Once he was removed, they could both cozy back up to Zuma as some kind of victim of white monopoly capital skullduggery or whatever it is, and start more openly bargaining with the ANC in terms of policy. And I see that the expropriation without compensation, sort of little technical differences in language in the draft amendment legislation, has become like an interesting case of the window. What's that window we call it?
The Overton window.
The Overton window being narrowed around a very extreme left position, so that you've got a lot of disagreement within a very, very narrow scope. So much so that now Melanie Verwoerd is arguing that the DA should come to the ANC's rescue by endorsing expropriation without compensation on the terms that the ANC is currently arguing for, rather than the terms that the DA, that the EFF is arguing for. Because, you know, if the Overton window is that small, then of course the ANC seems very centrist, if that's the only frame of reference that you have. So I do think that the EFF is succeeding in this role of folding itself back into the ANC's role, as the Tea Party was to the Republican Party, as the Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez, Bernie Sanders unit is to the Democratic Party in America more generally, really as one of the wings of the party that makes the rest of the party seem, I suppose, slightly more reasonable by contrast, and also that excites the radical elements of the base. That does seem to be playing out in parliamentary discussions. And I think that if the ANC does hold onto power through the 2020s, it might very well be by recourse to folding the EFF back into it officially and putting Malema and Floyd in cabinet if they survive VBS and so on.
Right. I think that this, though, is actually a tactic the ANC has used that is much older than the EFF, where they propose something that's completely wild, crazy, just out of bounds. And everyone objects and complains, and business finally decides to wake up and starts complaining about some provisions of it. And then the ANC reduces their position from 100% to 75%, and everyone goes, oh, you see, we made a huge difference. And yes, a difference is made in some real terms, but at the same time, you know, the Overton window has been shifted so much that we get some kind of crazy new imposition on our liberties and all that kind of stuff. Any final thoughts on this, Aaron?
And the problem is that the ANC has done that for as long as it's been in government, more and more. And generally, the power brokers on the other side, like business community, accept the 75% instead of opposing it altogether. So that's standard playbook stuff. Perhaps the EFF wants to sort of amalgamate back into the ANC just so that it can hide its corrupt leaders with a lot of other corrupt leaders. And they can, you know,
strength in numbers, like the herd of zebras.
Strength in numbers, and sort of hide behind, you know, mingle in the crowd. Where's Waldo? Mm.
Mm. Right, right. Mm. As long as they're outside, they're vulnerable potentially to prosecution. All right. Let us move on to our next story. And that is, so let me put it like this. I think a lot of South Africans know that alcohol fetal syndrome, which occurs when mothers drink while they are pregnant, and it causes many health effects for the children, is a big problem in South Africa. I think Helen Zille actually has talked about this being a very big problem, particularly in the Western Cape, but it affects all of South Africa's communities to some degree. It's a pretty big problem. And so it's no surprise then that the World Health Organization has mentioned it in what they're calling their Alcohol Action Plan 2022 to 2030. What's perhaps a little bit less understandable is the headline I read on Times Live, which said, World Health Organization want women of childbearing age to be banned from drinking alcohol. that's pretty explosive. So I went on to read, and to be fair, it's not quite that bad what the WHO is calling for, but it's also, let's just say, it's a little bit ambiguous. So the WHO says they want to, quote, boost the effective implementation of a global strategy to reduce the harmful effects of alcohol as a public health priority. And they say that to achieve these goals, they want to governments to take, quote, appropriate action to prevent the initiation of drinking among children and adolescents, prevention of drinking amongst pregnant women and women of childbearing age, and protection of people from pressures to drink, especially in societies with high levels of alcohol consumption, where heavy drinkers are encouraged to drink even more. So let's break this down a bit. It seems to me that you could interpret this charitably to say, oh, they just want people to be educated about the dangers. But there could be a darker side to this. Gabriel, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I said this to a woman of childbearing age, and her reply was, the WHO must just ban itself, which I think... I think that if you go over that quote carefully, you'll find that it speaks about prevention at the start in ways that are clearly legal. I mean, clearly there is a legal prevention of adolescents drinking in most countries around the world. It then talks about preventing women from drinking either while pregnant or while of childbearing age. That is to say, from the moment of ovulation until menopause. And that sounds legal. And then as a third thing it says, and also encouraging people not to sort of have peer pressure to be part of drinking culture. So that's one reason to be wary that that this language is not just about, campaigning, sloganeering kind of don't drink stuff, but really is about the law. Another reason is that the WHO was confronted with a huge amount of attention during 2020, and it gave some advice about how to deal with the coronavirus. And it was again given the option of advising people to wash their hands and wear masks and be careful and avoid large social gatherings. And it was also given the option to say, no, you can prevent that as government, and you must prevent that as government by the law, and not just briefly, but for a very long period. And their advice was very much to use the law, to use the iron fist rather than the intangible hand of the esteem economy, where you kind of praise people who go one way, maybe shame bad examples of those who go the other way, but to really use the iron fist of the law, which in South Africa's case caused 50 people to be killed by the police or to die in police custody just in the first 3 weeks of our hard lockdown, a hard lockdown which then extended just about longer than anywhere else in the world and saw 1.3 million people lose their jobs. The WHO's sort of propensity to urge governments to hold back from extreme legal intervention is, if it exists, rather invisible. I suppose where the WHO has urged governments or allowed governments to hold themselves back, it has been in the case of communist China, which the WHO has, at least through some subcommittee, sort of endorsed an investigation into the lab leak hypothesis, which came out saying, no, nothing went wrong here. And the government didn't intervene. And I suppose the WHO was sort of friendly with that idea. But for the rest, it's been very eager to encourage governments to get very brutal. And this has not yet been passed, like that subcommittee investigation. This is not like an official WHO position yet. It's being contested. But the fact that it's even being entertained in these terms, I think, is another indication that people who want to trust in science, people who do trust in science as a method and want to trust in a global institution gathered around the medical sciences, where experts really are going to give sober and judicious advice that is unambiguous and clearly protects life, livelihoods, and liberty, are being let down by institutions that instead play fast and loose with language and seem all too eager to intervene on the pretense that those in charge know what's right and everyone else is just a stupid ant that needs to be forced into decent behavior. And that corruption of our trust in particular scientific institutions unfortunately bleeds into a mistrust for science itself, for the fact that we live in one shared reality that really can be scrutinized and investigated using an age-old method of understanding. And I worry very much not only about the bad actions of the WHO, but also about those people who then want to resort to stargazing as a form of figuring out what's what.
So, Sarah, I suspect that some proponents of this these actions, especially if they were legislative, might say that men shouldn't comment on this debate, that we should hear women's voices. So, Sarah, it falls to you to represent all of womankind in this moment. Your thoughts on the WHO?
Let's put it this way. You know, it's been the practice in many countries to not allow kids to drink or into, access to drink under the age of 18. They produce their IDs or some form of ID. The idea of producing your ID from the age of 12 to 56 does strike me as it will face a rebellion in some countries. And it's just, even the, using the term is shows us almost a level of, I don't know, stupidity or carelessness. I can't quite say what. The other thing is that we are in the coronavirus era. Fetal alcohol syndrome is a huge problem but in parts of the world, not everywhere. So there are parts of the world that do have to tackle it. So unless the WHO really had something new and different to suggest, and that is all it is—it's a recommendatory body. I just think it's made its relevance to the world system, and particularly to the contribution to science. It's for the further sort of slid down the slippery slope of irrelevance.
Right. It feels a lot like that mush that so much of the UN is, that kind of doesn't really do much but gets a bunch of money to write reports that no one reads about, you know, restricting people's liberties.
Yeah. I mean, it's a sort of problem where it's very problematic, but it's also very specific in that it's common among certain groups of people in certain countries, and those countries that try to deal with it are going to continue trying to deal with it. Advice is always welcome, but you know, as Gabriel says, essentially you really want to trust the advisors, and I'm not convinced that we trust these guys much anymore.
Yeah. Right.
Also, it's perfectly fine to drink when you're 21, get pregnant at 22, and then like take a break from it, have the baby, do your breastfeeding, and then start drinking again. You don't That's have exactly to never drink because you might.
Further questions get raised by this. Like, if for example you find out that you're not fertile at 25, does that mean that you present your license or whatever?
I mean, I wouldn't use the word lightly, but I said. But there is a suggestion of sort of slightly idiotic misogyny in all of this.
Yeah. No, it's very odd. Anyway, I'm glad that beyond the halls of esteem, the WHO doesn't have much power over our lives, and that's probably a very good thing. Right, so for our last topic today, we don't have as much time to talk about it as we want, but it's probably worth going over. I think we may have mentioned it briefly a couple of weeks ago on the show. But I'm sure you've seen news coverage of it if you read anything of the mainstream press, and that is the shooting of a former South African rugby player, Lindani Mayeni, who was in the United States with his American wife. He was in Hawaii, and he was shot dead by cops. Now, this didn't provoke the huge reactions that some other shootings have provoked in the U.S., but his widow says that he was shot for racial profiling reasons and that the police treated him differently because he was a black man and that his shooting was unjustified. The police have said that he tried to attack them and they were completely justified in shooting him. So now the wife's legal team have managed to, they've taken the Honolulu Police Department, because I think that's where it was, to court to have this declared as an unlawful arrest in a civil suit after the department decided not to intervene. And they managed to get footage of the incident from a doorbell camera and from police body cameras released to the public. So you can go watch that on YouTube, and we put a link to it here so you can get a look for yourself. But I keep starting with Gabriel here today, but I'm going to do it again because he's the one who brought this to our attention. Gabriel, difficult to cover in a short amount of time, but what should we take away from this? Is this the crime that the defense or that that Mayeni's wife says it is?
I think the strongest argument is from that point of view is that the police did not identify themselves by shouting out "police" when they first arrived on the scene, and he Mayeni did ask, "Who are you? Who are you?" He asked that sort of while going towards a person who was shining a light and had a gun and was telling him, get down on the ground, get down on the ground. And he, instead of getting down, sort of comes at the guy and starts a physical assault. He says, who are you? The police say, taser him, taser him. He gets tasered. He fights off the tasers. Then a shot is fired. He manages to knock out. You hear F you coming from Mayeni, it sounds like. Then he knocks one of the police down onto the ground and is beating him down when the other two police officers, well, one of them opens fire and shoots Mayeni dead. So it's clear that he is attacking the police officer. It's clear that he's been doing so, and that it's not unreasonable to suppose that if he manages to completely overpower the police officer, he might take his firearm. And that's the sort of standard of lethal force application that American police apply. I think they failed to identify themselves properly. It's also, however, not completely unreasonable to suppose that he knew that they were police. Firstly, they are wearing police uniforms. Secondly, when they come in with a torch and the gun and say, get down on the ground. Thirdly, the bell camera footage and audio that comes from earlier shows Mayeni entering the house and Asian American people. The wife's English doesn't sound completely great, or she has an accent. Her English is fine, but she has an accent that's not American. Anyway, they call the police, and it seems pretty clear from the footage that he sees her calling the police, that he sort of says, I'm sorry, and leaves the house and then comes back in and says, can I see your phone? I know you guys. They say, we don't know you. And she's crying and telling 911, there's this guy in the house and he's coming at us and please come quickly because he's here. So he would know that the police are arriving on the scene when people then do come with guns and tell him to get down. It's hard to understand why he runs at them and then tries to physically overpower them. It's a very difficult thing to watch. I think it's worth watching. I think that everyone in the situation acted in a way that one would consider suboptimal. But I think in terms of the legal challenge of the police sort of committing culpable homicide or something like that, I think that's going to be a hard case to make without any more evidence. And the thought that this is that the police acted in the way that they did because he's black is really not supported by what we see on the footage. There's nothing about what happens that makes me think that if he was white, they would have said we're police. Their training seems to have failed them in that particular regard. But in terms of the rest, a guy running at you, you've got a gun, you're telling him to get down, he's not getting down. He tries to scrum you, he tries to punch. He eventually does punch one of the guys down to the ground, get in between his knees and punch him. These just all seem like the kinds of things that black or white, anyone who was doing it, American police would then shoot. And final word on this, I just wish I've been in America and I've been arrested by American police, and there, as in everywhere else, but especially there, when a gun is trained on one, I think the sound advice is to submit.
Sarah, your thoughts on this issue?
Yeah, I must say my experience, I haven't had direct experience with the police in the sense of being arrested, but they are scary. You know, they are, they've got badges and things all over. They're not meant to be messed with. The thing that really sort of surprised me, other than the fact that this video casts a lot of doubt on all sorts of things, is the fact that it's been touted by the legal representative of me and his wife as being contrary to the official version, which the police were very hush-hush about. And I think the problem is that it doesn't assist her case that much, if at all. So it's a very, very strange development. And I think we'd have to wait until this all unravels legally.
Right. I must say, so I encourage those who are interested in the story to go watch the video. It's everyone behaves quite weirdly. it is strange, and there's lots of kind of moments where you sort of think to yourself, why did this happen? At least that was what I thought when I watched it. But yeah, have a look for yourself, and as always, we'll wait to see what proceedings uncover. But it's certainly not clear, based on that, I think necessarily what exactly should have happened.
Yeah, it's also just the last strange thing to mention is just the person who calls 911. She's hyper emotional and very intense, and it's hard for her to communicate with anyone else. It's kind of worrying. It's hard to put oneself in anyone else's shoes in that kind of situation, but it does seem like if only everyone understood the situation a little bit better, no one would have died that night.
Yeah, definitely. Anyway, on that somber note, it is time for us to close. We will see you next week for the Daily Print Show, and have a wonderful weekend. Please support the IRR. SMS your name to the number behind me, 32823, and we'll call you back to sign you up as a friend. Thanks very much, everyone, and have a wonderful weekend.